Terry, it's a pleasure to have a chance to interview you and let the membership find out a little bit more about you. So many of the folks listening today and to the archives in the future will know you firsthand because of all the tech support you've given so many people over the years. And this is a chance for them to get to know a little bit about your history, your background. And we won't tell them that we had to twist your arm to do this, because we actually had to twist both your arms, didn't we?
Well, I don't know so much about that, but we just had to get everything right.
I'm going to let you do a lot of the talking, and I'd like you to start out talking about your childhood, where you grew up in your family setting and that kind of thing. I'll preface it by saying that Gary was born sighted and had his vision through his childhood, thank goodness. And tell us all about that cute little Jackson boy.
Well, I don't know so much about cute or anything like that, Jennifer, but I grew up in the same city I live in today, Groves, Texas, and I don't think I could have asked for a better place to grow up. After all, when you live on a street across from a park, in one corner the city swimming pool, and another corner Little League baseball park, in the park right in front of you. You know, how much more can you ask for as a kid growing up, along with, you know, your school right down the street, basically, in at the end of your street, approximately two blocks where I went to elementary school. And then another 100 yards or so across the field to junior high school. So close enough walking distance. I don't think I could ask for a better place to grow up. As a youngster, lots of kids in the neighborhood. Some near my age, some older, some younger. Just quite a place to grow up, because we never had a problem finding things to do with all of the kids in the neighborhood. We could always manage to gather enough to throw together a football game, you know, or something like that. Every Sunday afternoon, a football game was very common. Amongst other things. So it was just a great place to grow up, I can tell you that.
And I know you've told me you were a real active kid. You were always outside running and playing. You weren't inside with your nose in a book or glued to the TV, were you?
No, not at all. Unlike my older brother, who kept his nose glued to the TV, I think, when he grew up, when he was growing up, I pretty much was always outside doing something, tossing the football around, tossing the baseball around, riding bikes, you name it, all kinds of things. Just, again, nothing short there of finding things to do.
Yeah, it does sound like a great time. And this is your story, so I want you to tell it. But let me ask you a few questions. You had one brother and no sisters, is that right?
That's correct. Just one older brother. He's 4 years older. No sisters. So we did have a bit of a smaller family. My folks didn't get married until they were a little bit older, so I guess that after I was born, you know, they thought that would be enough. It probably made them decide that they didn't want to have any more children.
I'm not going to go there. Well, is there anything else during your elementary and high school years you'd like to talk about? You had a lot of interesting jobs. It sounds like you're a pretty responsible kid. And do you want to touch on any of that, or would you like to move on to your young adult years?
Well, before we get to the jobs, I guess, I did have some interesting things during my early teenage years, things that I have fond memories of, and would like to talk about a little bit. I joined an organization called DMLA when I was 13. It is an organization for young men aged 13 to 21, sponsored by the Masonic Lodge. And my neighbor, who was exactly 1 year older than me, we had the same exact birthday. Chances of that, can you imagine? He's 1 year older than I am. Had my application ready as soon as I turned 13. I joined the DMLA organization, and that was just a great time because, again, you have the guys everywhere from 13 to 21. Mostly 13 to 18. I don't know so much that there were too many older than that. So it was a great time. You kind of had a new family all over in an organization like that. And by the time I was 15, I became the head of my chapter, what they call master counselor, equivalent of a president of another organization, I suppose. So that was a great time. Also, when I was 15, I started, I helped manage a Little League baseball team. Very proud of that, and have fond memories of that, too. Little League was age 9 through 12, and at 12 is when I myself stopped playing, but at age 15, I should say a friend of mine and I went by the ballpark and approached the president of the Little League Baseball League to help out, to ask him if there were some, you know, possibly a team that we could help out. And he said, "You bet. There's a man that needs some help on his team right now." He said, "Tell you what, you fellas go over and talk to this fella, and I think he can use your help." So this friend of mine, Ron, and I did do that. He was 2 years older than me. Ron was 2 years older than me. But, so we did. I was 15. Now, Ron was obviously right at 17, maybe not quite. And it turned out that he got a job a short time later, so he kind of dropped out of that. The manager dropped out, and then they figured I was a little bit too young, I think, to take over a Little League team all by myself, only being a few years older than most of these kids anyway. So another man took over as manager, one of the fathers. He and I got along great and finished out the year as his assistant manager. So I had a great time during those years.
It sounds like it, and again, like I said, that you sound like a very responsible young man. Well, we've got Demolane, we've got the baseball team, and full circle friends in school. And now we graduate from high school. what do you decide to do with yourself? Where did you head next?
Well, when I graduated from high school, of course I was already working. I did start working when I was 16. When I turned 16, I went to work for an upholstery shop in one of the neighboring cities. I had a couple of friends that were already working there. They were, again, a couple of years older than I was. They were already working there, so they kind of helped me get my job there. And so when I was 18 and graduated, or rather 17, actually, I graduated earlier than 18, only because I was one of the younger ones in my class. After high school, I did go to college as a drafting major. I just knew when I graduated high school that drafting was what I wanted to do for a living. Basically, I think because, I had a couple of years of vocational drafting in high school. Vocational meaning those type courses, for those that don't know, 3 hour a day, my junior and senior year, I went to vocational drafting 3 hours a day for three class periods. And so by the time I graduated, I had it in my mind that that's exactly what I wanted to do. So I did go to college as a drafting major, although after about a year and a half in college as a drafting major, I had come to the conclusion that that was not what I wanted to do the rest of my life.
What did you have in mind at that point?
Well, to be quite honest with you, I'm not sure. That's been a while, and I'm not sure if I remember totally, but first, I was working. By that time, I had gone through a couple of part-time jobs, actually, and working part-time at Sears in the receiving department. I think very close to the same time that decision came along, or maybe it helped me make that decision. A full-time job as an assistant department manager at Sears in the hardware, sporting goods, and paint department, they were kind of all lumped together, came open, and they were taking applications for that job. So I got to thinking, that sounds like an interesting job. It was a full-time job. I knew that I would either have to drop out of college or go part-time at night only. And I think I entertained both options, but nevertheless, I applied for that job. And they gave it to me, which now I kind of believe is probably the worst thing they could have done at the time, meaning I guess I'm older and wiser and should have probably changed college majors like most smart college kids do instead of just dropping out and going to work full-time. Nevertheless, I did.
Out of curiosity, Gary, by the time you graduated high school, were you driving? What was the age for getting your license in Texas at that time? And when did you get yours?
The legal driving age was 16. I got my license at 16. I think you asked me what I was driving. My first car was a... let's see, I think my folks bought me, paid about $150 or $200 for, it was really just one that a mutual friend of the family, this fellow's parents had just been, you know, the car had been sitting in the yard for a while and just never, you know, did anything with or something like that. But anyway, I started driving at the age of 16.
Okay. And you've been in school, I think, a year, year and a half when you decided to take the full-time position with Sears. Is that right? How old are you at that point when you quit school?
At that time, I'm 19. They're about 19, yeah, when I decided that drafting wasn't what I wanted. I don't recall the exact month that I went to work in the hardware department as that assistant division or department manager, but that's approximately right.
Well, I know you didn't stay in that position. You made a lateral change. How long were you assistant manager for that department, and what was your next move in the company?
Yeah, I stayed there as that manager or assistant division manager for between a year and a half, I think. Another job came open in another department in commission sales. That would be the home improvement department. And it was a tough decision. But and I had gotten opinions from both sides on that, what was best, stay in management, go to commission sales. I did a lot of selling in the hardware department anyway. There were two of us full-time, the rest part-time. Needless to say, I did a lot of the selling anyway, so that part of it seemed to have come a little bit naturally. So I thought I could do pretty good in home improvement in the commission sales. So I guess ultimately I made the decision to go ahead and apply for that position that opened it. And again, they gave that position to me.
How long were you in that position of sales, and how old were you when that position ended?
I guess that went for another couple of years. I was in it, well, 2 to 3 years, I guess, because I was around 25 when I parted company with Sears. And at that point, well, I actually went to work for a friend of mine. I actually had a home improvement company of his own, he and his wife, you know, mom and pop business. And I left Sears, and I went to work for him doing sales because he said he could use somebody to do more of the selling part of, you know, his job or his company, and leave his time free, you know, for other things that he needed to be doing. So I did that, and again, a small company, but I did much better there than even at Sears.
And that was a good change for you then. How long were you with your friend's company, and where did you go next for employment?
I don't recall exactly how long I worked for him. Probably not a year until I decided to go back to college, I said that was probably the best thing I could have done. You know, I needed to go back to college and change that major, go to something else. So I worked for him, and it was good. I liked it. Again, it was a small company, so I was on straight commission. That's the way it had to be with him. He just couldn't possibly afford to pay somebody an hourly, you know, wage or salary. Until I went back to college, I worked for him. And then I went to a part-time job again.
Okay, so you're back in school, back in college, and thinking about that change in your major. How old are you at this point, Gary?
Thinking 25 to 26, somewhere in that neighborhood at that point.
Okay. So I think maybe we skipped over something important here. By this time, do you know you're a diabetic?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I became diabetic at age 12, actually. I'll let you go from there.
I think we talked before that your brother was a diabetic, so you weren't totally freaked out when you got the news that you were as well. And as unpleasant as maybe stabbing the stick yourself in that aspect of diabetes when it didn't slow you down as a child. It sounded like you still had a very full, active life. And I just did want to make the point that you were diabetic, and because that's about to become a big part of your story here. So you're back in school, and what happens there?
I go back to school as a business major with a concentration in computer science. Most of it's business. If I had graduated with that, that would be a BA degree. Again, I'm going back to college as a full-time student and then going back and working part-time. At that point, I went to work for a restaurant, a barbecue restaurant, mom-and-pop owned local barbecue restaurant.
And you were really the evening manager for this barbecue house, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what he had in mind when he hired me. He, as anybody else would, I mean, the husband and wife team, you know, that owned this place were there from 8 or 9 in the morning. They didn't want to be there at 8 or 9 in the evening, obviously. He needed somebody he could rely on to be there in the evenings and close the place down, make sure everything was geared up and ready to go for the next day business. And so he basically hired me as sort of a night manager.
Well, how long were you in school this time around, Gary? You went back somewhere between 25 and 26. And how long were you there before it became necessary to quit classes again?
Well, I started having vision trouble. Kind of came upon me pretty quick when I was 28. And that, along with another injury that I had on the job at the time that put me in the hospital caused me to need to cancel classes that I was already signed up for. I think that would have been in the fall semester of 1988, if I remember that right.
Would this have been your junior year in college or your senior year? Where in your four-year program were you?
Junior year would be about right. I was taking junior level classes as well as some others too. I didn't necessarily have all junior level classes simply because I actually went to two different campuses of the same university.
Well, that must have been interesting. Well, you had really a terrible bout of very poor health. And tell us as much or as little as you want to about that with the different health issues you had going on, including that with your vision.
Well, I had the vision trouble due to diabetes, diabetic retinopathy. I saw an eye doctor, and he immediately started treating me for the retinopathy. That was, something that took a little bit of time because when I actually saw the doctor, there was already fairly extensive damage, and it's not a thing that he could do all of the laser treatments that he needed to do on my retinas all at one time. It was something that he really had to stretch out over. I don't recall now. I'm going to say at least a several month time frame to get to a point where he was satisfied with, the work he had done and that he had managed to stop the damage and let things kind of settle down. And from that point, he sent me to since I still did have some vision, I was legally blind, but at the same time, obviously had some usable vision. And he sent me to a low vision specialist. Let me get that right. Low vision specialist, basically an optometrist, I think, that works with patients to get everything they can out of their, what their usable vision is. And I worked with him on and off for a while. Usually around an hour at a time, or an hour to hour and a half at a time, until I had more trouble with the eye, the vision, and at some point it became non-productive to even, keep going back to him, and and up until the point, I know it's right, January of 1989, because of glaucoma in my right eye, which was my best eye, I had to have it removed, and my retina specialist, being a ophthalmologist and a surgeon, that actually did that surgery, but it was a necessary thing. Even though I lost quite a bit of usable vision in that procedure, I had something that, at that time at least, they had no medication to give me for the pressure, and without the right kind of medication to be able to take for the pressure, that amount of pressure. There was no way that a patient could, you know, take the pain associated with it. So he eventually had to remove that eye with, you know, no choice. And did, and so I went through that. And from that point, it was a, you know, one thing sort of after the other, I guess. I went through that, got recovered, and somewhere in the meantime, one of my other doctors, my diabetic doctor, had seen some blood chemistries that he didn't like and sent me to a kidney doctor, and it was determined that I had renal failure or chronic renal failure. I was not yet at a point where I needed to be on dialysis, but apparently, I don't know how that works exactly. Apparently, there's some way those doctors know from what they're seeing in blood chemistries that you are experiencing chronic renal failure, and it's only a matter of time until dialysis is inevitable. So he told me that. He said, well, you have chronic renal failure. You're not going to be on dialysis just yet, but eventually you will be. He told me at that point, he said, you don't need to be on dialysis, but I am going to go ahead and send you to Galveston. That's Galveston, Texas, of course. I don't know that there's another one that exists, but to start through their program to get on a waiting list for a kidney and possibly kidney pancreas transplant. So he made those arrangements, and I started exactly that. I went to Galveston, got signed up, started going through their testing procedures that they always do for transplant patients or potential transplant patients. And it must have been another several months before my kidney doctor actually decided that I needed to be on dialysis. So I did. I had to go on dialysis. And a few months later, I suppose I actually got put on a waiting list. Actually, around the same time, I got put on a transplant waiting list by the transplant surgeon in Galveston and on dialysis around that same time by the local kidney doctor. So I was on dialysis for about a year, which I do consider myself to be lucky in that respect. There are those that are on less than a year, and there are those that are on more, so I don't know if there's necessarily a specific time frame that anybody could give you on something like that. One just never knows, and it's always depends. In terms of transplants, organ transplants, that kind of thing always depends on when organs become available that match for you.
Yes, and I know a lot of criteria have changed too. I don't know that you could have gotten on that waiting list today until you actually had to have dialysis. And not that needing a transplant could ever be considered a lucky scenario, but you were lucky in the respect that you also had a successful pancreas transplant along with your kidney. After you had the transplant, Gary, did you enjoy a significant improvement in the way you felt?
Absolutely. I do want to comment on what you said, though. You're absolutely right. I consider myself, and anybody else for that matter, fortunate enough to be in that position of getting the pancreas transplant along with the kidney is just absolutely, to a diabetic, it's almost the best thing that can happen, because at least after some period of time, you don't have to do the daily blood sugars, the insulin injections, and all the other associated things with that. So the pancreas transplant, and plus it's safeguarding your other organs and your kidney mainly at the same time. That's the reason the doctors tend to lean that direction with diabetic patients that need a kidney transplant. At least the doctors that I've dealt with always lean that direction of doing the double transplant, because after all, diabetes caused in the diabetic patient anyway the renal failure to start with. So if you eliminate what caused it to start with, you are safeguarding the new transplant, the transplanted kidney, I should say. So that's I consider myself to be very lucky in that respect, that I did get the pancreas transplant and have been diabetes free for now just over 15 years. And now that I've said all of that, I think I forgot your question.
I think you answered it. Well, among all the heartache and suffering you did, and I know you really suffered with the eye and your other physical problems as well, you also had a terrible bout of a very serious gallbladder disease. Did you not?
Oh, yes. Just when I thought I was getting over, I guess, the transplant surgery, or had, managed to get over that and get healed up pretty good and think your life is back in order, I suppose. I started having some other major symptoms. I didn't know anything about gallbladder disease or gallstones or anything like that. I just knew that something was tearing my gut up after I ate, and it was kind of spooky, I guess, not knowing that there's usually, something else that causes it, or could be something else. So, in that respect, yes, I started that, and again, probably a couple of years after the transplant surgery, and it took a while for them to get that diagnosed properly as being gallbladder disease or just having gallstones. I'm not sure why, honestly, but I did go through that and wound up back in Galveston having the same doctor, the same surgeon, I should say. My transplant surgeon does a lot more than just transplants. I think her second home is surgery. So she actually did my gallbladder surgery, and it turns out that it was when she came to talk to me after the surgery, she said, well, it sure did need removing. She said that it was completely packed with stones, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tiny stones. And of course, even then, which was back in the mid-90s, they were doing this newer laparoscopic surgery that some people refer to as Band-Aid surgery, where they basically make several small incisions. And I asked her about that, and she explained to me, she said, in your case, we can't do that because that's where they do the transplant, basically right down the midsection in your navel area is where they cut you when they do the transplant surgery. And again, that's where they would make incisions for the gallbladder operation if they were to do the laparoscopic surgery as they do nowadays. She explained that after having the surgery like that transplant, there would be too much scar tissue that she would not be able to do that procedure, so that she would have to do it, quote-unquote, the old-fashioned way with the typical, you know, incision large enough to get to the gallbladder and take it out.
And I know you were glad when they finally figured out what was wrong and got rid of that one, too. Well, all right, so you've had your transplant, and they finally figured out what was going on with the gallbladder. And how old are you now, Gary, when life has settled down a little bit from a medical perspective?
At that point, probably 36 or 37 or something like that.
And again, your brother, 4 years older and a juvenile diabetic, did not experience the blindness or the need for a transplant, so he's very lucky in that regard, I guess. Is it about this time you decide that you're going to tackle the wonderful world of Windows?
Not quite. Well, I looked into it. I had been kicking it around because, after all, I heard about computers on a daily basis on ham radio. Became a ham radio operator somewhere along 94, it was actually. I was licensed in 94 as a ham operator, and by the mid, 95, 96, 97, along in there, many, many more people were getting personal computers. So I heard about it on a daily basis from others, and so I had started looking into it. I didn't know very much about screen readers. I didn't know much, you know, about personal computers at all. I had only had a limited amount of experience with computers, and that was in programming. So I looked into it a little bit, but the research that I did maybe wasn't extensive enough at that point. I just got the idea when I started talking to certain people and that they hadn't advanced quite enough, maybe, With Windows anyway, maybe they had with the DOS, since it was already out of the DOS era for the most part, but I mean, it's not totally out of the DOS area, you know, but or era, but I did kick it around and decided, well, maybe I better hold off a few years till this screen reader technology gets better.
You know, something we passed over, and I know it was very important in your life, and that's after you became 21, you became a Mason, and I think rose to the highest position within that organization. Do you want to touch on that?
Sure. That's correct. As I said, I grew up as a member of the DMLA organization from the age of 13, and that the age range for that organization is 13 to 21. At 21, it's not as though they throw you out of the DMLA organization. It's just that you become what they call a senior DMLA. You can no longer, you're no longer what they call an active DMLA. You have no voting privileges or anything like that. You can still go to meetings and such, but you cannot vote on issues or things like that. But at age 21 is the age you have to be to become a Mason. And, of course, growing up in the DMLA organization sponsored by the Masonic Lodge, I was already familiar with many Masons and just thought that that was a fine bunch of men. So at 21, of course, I was ready to turn in my petition for membership to the Masonic Lodge, and did. At age 21, that was, I guess, would be in August. That takes a little bit of time. By January, I was a Master Mason. There are several degrees you go through. You have to be a Master Mason to, at least here. Some places I don't think that is the case, but business meetings of the lodge are all conducted in what we call a Master Mason's Lodge, meaning you have to be a Master Mason. You can't be a lower degree Mason and attend those meetings and actually vote on the business of the lodge and so forth. So I became a Master Mason in January of... let's see what year that would be. 1982 is when I became a Master Mason. That summer, because our what we call the Masonic year actually is from June to June, and by that summer, I was asked by the Worshipful Master, for those people that don't know that what that is in the Masonic Lodge, on a local basis, the head of the lodge is called the Worshipful Master. And he has the authority to appoint certain positions, and I was asked by the ingoing Worshipful Master to be his junior steward, which was the lowest in my lodge. he had two positions to fill. It just so happened. Ordinarily he would have just had one, but there was a man that dropped out due to health reasons. And he based that decision on my record that he knew of from the DMLA organization. And he knew that if I went through all of the offices, eventually I would be Worshipful Master or Master of the Lodge. And decided that that I was the one that he wanted. That was an appointed office, but it was a natural progression up.
And I know that's one of your many accomplishments during that time. Well, Gary, I always say there's no good time, good age, or good way to go blind. And we all go through our adjustment period. How do you feel you adjusted, and what do you think helped you along the way?
Well, that's a good question and also a tough one. I guess I became blind, and I guess the first 5 or 6 years of being blind, I had actually what I would call so many other issues going on that probably kept my mind off of the part about, you know, being blind. Initially, I'm sure I was not real happy about it because I had to stop driving, of course, at some point. That was always tough, because it's not as though I went blind suddenly. It was all gradual. And at some point, you have to come to the conclusion that you're dangerous when you go out there and get in your car or your truck and drive around. And that's a tough decision for a sighted person, for those people that have been through it, you know what I mean. So I think probably the fact that I had some other medical issues that, you know, were even more serious than blindness probably helped, you know, keep my mind off of being blind those first, you know, initial, you know, 5 or 6 years. After that, I turned to other things such as ham radio and it eventually computers, as well as the lodge. I was still involved in the lodge and the DMLA organization as an advisor, various things like that, all helped. I would say one way or the other. So I know that many people go blind or, you know, have vision trouble, don't necessarily have other medical issues besides that, and they probably focus more totally on the blindness part of it than the other things. So I'm sure in a way that helped.
Yeah, and I think for all of us, just a matter of degree, it's a lifetime process, adjusting to losing your vision. You're a bachelor, and you've never been married, and I believe you were fairly serious about someone at that time. And do you think your blindness or all your other physical problems, affected that relationship?
Absolutely. Yeah, that would have been actually about halfway during that year that I was on kidney dialysis, I had been in a relationship for a couple of years and with a woman, and I really can't say for sure which part it had to do with, but I do believe that some part of that, whether it was my blindness, whether it was that I was on dialysis and waiting for a transplant, in a way, I think that probably scared her. I know there was no guarantee in terms of how long it would be before the transplant or anything like that. I often have to wonder whether or not she really thought that I would ever live very long anyway, over a couple of years. I have to think that it had more to do with that than it did the blindness, because I don't think she really never, you know, considered the blindness a big problem. But, yes, it did affect that relationship.
And I told you during our pre-interview I was going to ask you this. You've never been married, but what do you think the likelihood of that single status changing might be?
I think it's always a possibility. I certainly haven't given up, but I'm 46. I think that's way too young to be considering giving up on that. After all, nowadays, as you well know from personal experience, I suppose even many people become divorced in their, you know, 40s, 50s. Sure, that's always a possibility.
See, I just wanted to give all those gals out there in your FTP harem a thrill.
I don't know whether you gave them a thrill or scared them.
Oh, I'll take a vote after your interview. How's that? All right. So you've gotten past all this horrendous medical trouble. You've got your kidney and your pancreas. You've been blind 5 or 6 years and dealing with that. And you've been pretty busy with Masons and being a mentor or what have you to the Demily and ham radio and all the other things. Now you decide to knuckle down and dive into computers. Did we skip anything major before we move on to this section of your life, Gary?
Well, let's see. What was that when I told you about one of my jobs and you busted out laughing and said you thought that I had always been a geek?
Oh, it blew me away when I learned that Gary, one of his jobs at the hospital, was in the maintenance crew. I mean, he's a regular old handyman, and, you know, I just always thought of him as his nose in a Jaws tutorial or tweaking around with computers. It just blew me away that he was a down and dirty, hands-on maintenance dude. So, and I forget what job you were telling me you were doing. It just really shocked me. I thought it was great.
Well, that would have been the close to the last part-time job I had after I went back to college that second time. I went to work for one of the local hospitals here in the engineering or maintenance department, and that may be a job out of all that I had that I enjoyed the most. You got a chance to deal with people, fix a little bit of everything. You know, it wasn't just one thing. You didn't focus on one specific thing all the time, all the time. There was always something new that came up that you had to figure out, okay, how are we going to fix this problem? Obviously, certain things you have to learn more about and get more skilled at, but from one, you know, half hour to the next, you never knew what you were going to be working on. So I thoroughly enjoyed the job, and actually at one point was even offered a full-time job doing just exactly that, and I turned it down because I told the man at the time, the director of that department, at the time, that well, I said, you know, I appreciate the offer, but I have made this mistake, you know, one time in the past, and meaning dropping out of school and going to work full time, and I said, I'd rather not do that this time. I said, I like what I'm doing, and if the offer still stands when I get finished with college and I don't have something else, another offer, I should say, staring me in the face at the time when I graduate college, I'd be happy going to work full time here, doing exactly that.
Yeah, I could tell the way you talked about that job that you really loved it, and we discussed how the hospital personnel, a lot like FTP, was kind of its own closed community, a family of sorts, in that it wasn't just people in your department, but you got to interact with people all over the hospital and came to know them.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You made friends all over. Of course, you got to remember that, and maybe you worked a little bit in this kind of area too, but people like nurses, or doctors or whatever, hospital personnel, no matter where they work, if they've got something that doesn't work in their department, especially in the summertime, if and it's hot and their air conditioner's not working right, or in the wintertime and it's cold and their heater's not working right, or something, no matter what it is that they need serviced, they're always glad to see the maintenance people. So, as you go around the different departments of the hospital, you know, fixing the things that you get called in, you meet people and you make friends with them, and I have some long-lasting friends from that job, actually. I know I've spoke to one of them at least recently that was of all things a charge nurse on the diabetic floor of that particular hospital. Eventually went into diabetic education actually, and I've stayed in touch with her ever since.
I imagine you were, when you got that air conditioning working or whatever it was, you were their hero of the hour. Just just like you are to so many people here when you fix what's broken with their computers.
Yeah, like I said, that's sure. I mean, anytime you have to, you need help from somebody else. I guess that's the way it works. You know, they appreciated, you know, the fact that somebody else was doing that, and occasionally it took us a little bit longer to get to it than they thought it should, but that's unfortunately the way it is. You can't schedule problems. Problems happen when they happen, and unfortunately sometimes too many problems happen at the same time, and it takes a little bit longer for the people that are there to fix the problems to get to them.
Yeah, well, when it's 90 degrees at a nursing station, no one feels like an angel of mercy, I guess. Well, what do you say? Are we about at the point where you introduced yourself to computers?
Yeah, I guess so. I got my... again, I was interested in computers, I guess, as I said earlier. Back in the mid-90s or so, around 96 to 97 or something like that, and decided that maybe I'd better wait on that. So I waited a few years. It was not until the year 2000, about, I believe it was April, I decided that I was just going to spend the money. I didn't have a state agency that was going to pay for it, because I was not a student. It was not required for a job. I decided that I was going to bite the bullet, spend the money, buy the computer, which I had already looked into. The computer, you know, was, I don't know exactly, but I'm saying somewhere around $900 or so. And JAWS, which I really kind of got lucky in that respect. Ordinarily, it would have been $800, I think, at that time. Got it through the state for a fair discount anyway, buying it through the state. I guess I had decided on the computer and JAWS. I have to say, a lot of that had to do with somebody that most everybody knows as Rebel. Many people probably don't know that, but Rebel and I had known each other for probably, at this time we've known each other for right at, I would say, a good 11 to 12 years. The first 5 to 6 years of that, of course, having to do with ham radio. In 2000, I knew a couple of blind guys, Rebel, of course, and one other, also on ham radio, that were computer operators. And, of course, we know Rebel was a JAWS user. The other one was a Window Eyes user. I knew nothing about either program, but I knew, out of the two guys that I knew, one a Window Eyes user, one a JAWS user, I knew which one was more accessible, and I have to give Rebel a lot of credit in that respect. I mean, he was my go-to guy after buying my computer and JAWS for a good solid several months when I was first getting started.
I I know, and Rebel Brad's on you a lot too. He said he'd ask you about, you'd ask him about some component of Jaws, and he'd say, honestly, I don't know. And he said, it might be a day or two, but you'd come back and say, Rebel, I figured that out. And he said that in your case, it was a matter of the student bypassing the teacher. And I know he's very complimentary of your Jaws know-how. When you first met Rebel on him, were you sighted or blind?
No, I was blind. That was in 1994 or 5. I was blind. I did not become a ham radio operator until I was blind. I was already blind at that point.
Oh, that's right. Well, what else do you want to talk about in the interim there before you became a very active member of For the People? I have lots of questions for you about that, but is there anything else you'd like to cover in that interim?
I just, again, I would say that when I became a computer, or rather a PC computer, you know, personal computer operator, I depended on Rebel a lot the first few months, and he eventually, once he understood that, or knew that I was capable of handling, you know, certain things, he would introduce me to something else. And what I'm talking about is, because when I bought my computer in Jaws, I did not know how to type. I did not know the keyboard at all. I had never taken typing. I had some programming classes in college, some 12 years prior to that, and quite honestly, when I did that, it was one of those hunt and peck situations on the keyboard when I had to type those programs in. I honestly never learned typing. I always thought that it was beyond my capability, or there was something that would be next to impossible to learn. So I guess when I bought the computer, I had to learn typing, learn Jaws, and learn PCs or Windows, you know, at the same time. So Rebel deserves a lot of credit for helping me through that time frame. Once he decided that I had graduated to a level that I could handle it, he introduced me to one of the best things he probably could have done, and that was the JFW Lite mailing list for JAWS users. And as many of you know, we still use that website as of today. Wonderful lady that started that site, Debbie Scales. Rebel was a member of that list, introduced me to the list once he decided I could handle the traffic of email. And I became a little bit active with that, but learned so much from that list and Debbie Scales. That was a tremendous amount of my computer training years, I suppose.
I know, and so many, including you, were so terribly sorry that she died so unfortunately, so young. we've been talking for over an hour now, and I want to make sure folks have a chance to ask you questions and put in their two cents, Gary. So I'm going to move on to FTP now in your interaction with the site. Probably one of the nicest things that ever happened to me was you joining For the People and becoming so active personally, other than our friendship, which I value highly. You have been such a huge asset to the site in terms of all your tech team hours, thousands of hours, and your effort. You've put together a wonderful tech team, and PCQ&A has become a vital part of For the People. And above and beyond that, your role as vice president and the active role you take in setting and guarding the policies of the site. I just want to have a chance to thank you for all you've done for the site. And everyone listening knows what you mean to us. I want to know what For the People means to you.
Well, as you know, I do tech support because I like it. There's a tremendous amount of satisfaction from it, or that you get from helping somebody resolve that problem that they need to get resolved. You can't always do it, and of course that's always a bit of a letdown, but you have to accept that you can't help everybody with every problem. And I never claim to know it all, or even a significant, you know, part of it. First, I'd like to say that I do have a wonderful tech team, and most of them are way beyond my personal computer capabilities. But so I get a lot out of For the People. It's helping people. It's always making new friends. For the People is a family, and I don't know about everybody. I can't speak for anybody else, but personally speaking, For the People is probably a larger part of my family than my family is. Or it's at least now, it's more significant part of my life than my own family. Now, that doesn't mean it is for everybody, because I don't have a lot of brothers and sisters, or children, wife, things like that, as many people do. So obviously For the People, it's not going to be the same to everybody, but still, For the People's a family, and hopefully it's a family to everybody, and they feel that way, at least some part of their family, where they can go and talk to people with some of the same problems. We all share some of the same problems, and hopefully people know that For the People is a family. They can come to the site and find a friendly voice, and from somebody that shares their problems, their blindness, and the difficulties they face, where sighted people often don't understand.
Well, I agree with you, and I often think that, we come here and we talk about excess technology and screen reader problems, but on an emotional level, we can totally forget we're blind. whether we're interacting with all our other blind friends here or our sighted friends here. It's a true comfort zone in terms of that. And again, you've helped so many people, and so many people on the site love you, Gary. And I've become very good friends with you. And I know they're all anxious to put their two cents in. I want to ask you a few just general interest questions before we turn it over to the floor. But do you have anything else you want to say before I get to the lighthearted side of things?
No, I don't guess. Well, I will say it's been a privilege to be a part of For the People, and both as part of the tech team and part of management now, and I appreciate your confidence in me. So hopefully I've done something right along the way.
Yeah, and that's a big 10-4. I'm sorry, ham radio operator talking CB at you. All right, here's some tough questions. Your favorite song?
You're right about that. Tough question is not the word for that. Oh, I can't, I just can't dream of what a favorite song would be. There's lots of favorite songs. I just can't think of one song that is absolutely a total favorite.
Okay, well, if you think of one of your favorite songs before we're done, tell me, what are your favorite artists, singers?
As you know, I'm a country music fan. Doesn't mean that I won't listen to other music, of course. I'm just more, you know, in country, and I guess I have a lot of, you know, particular favorites there too. Some older, some newer. I will tell you that Charlie Daniels is a particular favorite of mine, both for, well, his entertainment, his talent, his singing and entertainment abilities, and that I admire him for his patriotism and what I call just an absolute stand-up guy. He's absolutely proud to be an American, so to speak, and won't back down from, you know, anybody or anything when it comes to that. And he's done quite a bit over his career in terms of, you know, just doing, you know, some really good things. Just in and most recently, I suppose, taking a tour, I guess, you know, to entertain the troops in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Kuwait. He's one that I just, like I said, I really admire the man. And I've actually, as you know, when we've done musical mirrors before, I don't know if you remember that, probably not, but I actually used one of his songs as one of my musical mirrors.
I do remember, and this is probably the perfect time to say that your interview is being presented on Veterans Day, and God bless America, and God bless each and every one of our military people active today, and all who have served for our country and for freedom. Okay, you were sighted over half of your life. How about one or two favorite colors?
Blue has always been my favorite color, I think. I don't know why. I had blue eyes. I have blue eyes, I guess. I might as well say. I still have one, and then the other that's been made to match it. But blue, for the most part, my school colors were pretty nice too, purple and white, but again, you always associate that with some of the best time of your life, high school.
That's true, and I'm so glad your eyes match. All right, a couple of your favorite aromas.
Well, I'd have to say without a doubt, coffee would be one of them. I'm sure that'll be a surprise to some people. How about, how about bacon? Cooking, you know, bacon or something like that. I suppose that would be one of my favorites.
Well, they're two good choices to, in my book, too. All right, and your last frivolous question, a couple of your favorite foods.
Well, I guess I don't know the absolute top, but I would say shrimp is probably one of them. Living here near the Gulf Coast, of course, we have fresh shrimp, quite a bit of the year. And, of course, many seafood restaurants. So I would say shrimp tops that list or comes close anyway. Outside of that, very possibly, I would probably have to say beef one form or another, whether it's a real nice steak or just a, you know, nice tender brisket or, you know, roast or something like that I like other things too, but maybe not quite as well. The ham is always good, but I suppose that'll do it.
Yep, they all sound yummy to me. Well, you can keep the shrimp. I want to thank Callie for coordinating Spotlight, thank our recorders, and John for recording the interview itself, which will be aired Saturday, Veterans Day, November 11th, 2006. And a huge thanks to you, Gary, for all you do for the people, and an even bigger thank you for being my friend. Thank you.
Thanks for the kind words, Jennifer. I'm proud to be your friend. I'm kind of no thanks necessary in that department. It's all stuff that I enjoy, so I do it without, you know, expecting thanks in return, I suppose. I enjoy it.
Well, you're humble, but it's always good to hear it when you deserve it. All right, I'm going to turn it over to the floor, and everyone in the Gary Jackson Armadillo/Monster Fan Club, grab your control keys.